Hard to believe this is it. The big finish. The grand finale. Matt Mittler here with Kaufman's Holiday. Closing out part 3, A Beacon of Light. We know a lot now about this story. But as with most stories, the more we know, the more questions we have. And questions are what it's all about on Sunday Night Noir. So, here's the capper, episode 15. It's gonna be tight, just 2 chapters. And at the end, maybe you'll have some answers. And maybe you won't. At any rate, my job will be done. The rest is up to you. Farshtasht. And now, Chapter 80. When it comes to justice, we can't always rely on God, can we? The question gummed up on the roof of his mouth. Nothing to do with Harlow, though. It was the trench coat he was thinking of. Guy wasn't some sociopath. He was just balancing the scales. Same as Mara. Same as Harlow. Taking matters into their own hands. The whole journey rushed by in Kaufman's mind. He was tagged the moment he hit the docks. Shadowed on every step. How stupid could he have been? The Delahaye spun out onto Memorial Boulevard, 90 miles an hour, flashing by every other auto. He could spot the Ferris wheel off at the end of the boardwalk, a Lilliputian erector set. He pushed it to 100, swerved into the lot, banking halfway up the curb, snapped off the engine, and raced over to the merry-go-round. Goldstein was waiting, grabbed him by the sleeves.
"Mo! What the hell?"
His eyes bugged at the bloodied shirt.
"It's nothing, Goldie. Where's Eli?"
"What do you mean, nothing? Jesus Christ, Mo! You got a bullet hole in you."
"I said it's nothing. What's the score?"
"It ain't good. Your brother's called the cops. There's 3 patrol cars. One's got your old Hal Roach hotheads. They're all scanning the premises. But the girl... she's been nabbed."
Kaufman glared at Goldstein.
I'm sorry, Mo,"
Goldstein stammered.
"On me mother's life, I was watching. She was on the carousel. Passed by once, twice, and then, poof, she was gone. I phoned you right away."
"Any note? Anything?"
"Dunno. I've been keeping clear."
"Good. That's good, Goldie. All right. Wait for me."
Kaufman spotted his brother among a fleet of blues, edged over to a popcorn stand.
"Eli,"
he whispered. No notice. He tried again, amping the volume.
"Eli!"
Eli rubbed the remorse off his mug and marched over.
"Damn you, Moses! This is all because of you. They've got my Rachel."
"Was there a note, Eli?"
"A note! A note!"
"A note? Was there a note?"
"Yes, there was a note. Police have it."
He balled up a fist.
"All you bring is Soros."
"What did it say?"
The fist unfurled. Tears flooded his eyes.
"It said go to hell."
"What did it say, Eli? Eli, you've got to let me help."
Eli noticed the stains on Kaufman's suit. Oh, God, Moses, you're shot. What is this? What? What? He bowed his head, hands raised to heaven.
I'm all right, Eli. Tell me about the note.
The note? I don't know. I don't know. Something about a castle, sunset and a castle. It didn't make any sense. None of this makes any sense.
It did to Kaufman. Eli, I need you to keep the cops here. You hear me, Eli? Just stay put. I'll get Rachel. I promise. I'll get her back.
Ain't seen you behind the wheel in a dog's age, Mo. Driving the company car, no less.
Kaufman hadn't even realized it himself. His heart started to chatter.
You want out, Goldie? Just say the word. Your choice to tag along. This one's not your battle.
None of them are. Guess I'm just a glutton for punishment.
Goldstein held onto his hat as they tore down Bellevue. At least he had one to hold. Trees swept by overhead, the last vestiges of light cutting through the leaves. Kaufman clutched the wheel and took a right onto Ruggles without braking. Goldstein crouched down in his seat.
Always preferred the scenic route,
he said weakly. Kaufman didn't respond. He could barely even breathe. They flew past Lily Pond, where the avenue switched to Hazard. His mouth was set hard, and his palms began to sweat. He could have taken Wickham the other way around. Might have shaved off a second or two. Why didn't he? The Delahaye tore onto Ocean Drive at Cherry Neck, heading west to Brenton Point. Brenton Point. That's it. That's where he'd handed the wheel over to Therese. In the blink of an eye, he was back. He took a swig, reached over blindly, dragging his fingertips up the curve of her collar, grabbed her ear, and pulled at the tender flesh.
Moleki pentelu,
she cursed. In English, por favor. She jerked her head over and bit his wrist, shook her sable locks. He leaned in to feast on her scent. Sun was setting. Shrouds of fog caressed the winding road. A wave sprayed over the stones and rained in through the open top. She squealed like a porpoise.
Bejou,
she puckered up.
Not while you're driving.
Bejou.
Watch the road. I'll never let you drive again.
Meu bebida.
She yanked the flask from him, dripped out the last drops, and licked her lips.
Meu manchi.
She purred, lashes half-mast. That's when she saw the beacon from the lighthouse, and that's when everything changed. Of course, Kaufman would have to return here. In some ways, he'd never left.
Castle Hill Lighthouse?
Goldstein was crammed against the passenger door.
That where we're headed? You think the kid's there?
What other castle could it be? This creep's got me inside and out. If he wants to see me suffer, I'll abide. But me, no one else.
Ahead, a singular shaft of light sliced across the sea. The Delahaye lurched off the drive and onto the footpath, headlights blasting against the tower. Kaufman took the car as far as he could, but wasn't about to go over the bluff. That bit of history would not be repeated.
Uncle Moses!
Her tiny voice strained over the roaring waves. On top of the tower, he could make out the silhouette of the trench coat, the wide-brimmed hat and lit cigarette. The figure lifted the girl, her feet kicking the air. Kaufman left the engine running and raced across the rocks, threw open the door, and lunged up the stairs. The ascent seemed endless. Pain cleaved his chest in two, and blood pumped from the open wound, seeped through his shirt and down his trousers. Thick, warm. He gripped the handrail, spiraling, spiraling, hoisting himself up the turret. Could hear Goldstein behind, wheezing like a rusted harmonica. Feet clanked the steel steps, echoing, slamming against his eardrums. Kaufman exploded out onto the crow's nest, mouth stretched, gulping air. There he was, collar up, hat down, outlined by the crimson torch of the setting sun, and holding Rachel out over the edge.
"Jesus, Mo!"
Goldstein hunched behind him, panting.
"What the hell's this guy want?"
"He wants me."
Kaufman took a cautious step forward.
"Uncle Moses!"
Rachel cried. A swirl of smoke rose from the cigarette, wrapping around her.
"I'm here, Rachel. Don't be afraid."
He took another step, breathed.
"Just look at me. Look at Uncle Moses."
A piercing wail speared the sky. Kaufman faltered.
"What the hell was that?"
"It's a siren, Mo. Must be the cops."
"Jeez, I thought it was me. Glad you're here, pal. Stick close."
He reached back and grabbed Goldstein by the lapel, yanked him up to his flank, and shouted ahead.
"Hey, you! You don't want to do this. You don't want to hurt the girl."
No reply, just the swelling glow of the cigarette.
"Help me, Uncle Moses."
"I will, kiddo," he assured. "Mister, release the girl. Please, just set her down."
A puff of smoke spat out the corner of his mouth, but still no response.
"Mo, use your gun."
"Just keep an eye on Rachel, Goldie. If he puts her down, you get her the hell out of here."
"You got it, Sarge."
Goldstein placed a hand on Kaufman's back.
"Rachel!"
Kaufman continued to inch ahead.
"Uncle Moses, I'm scared."
Tears streamed down her cheeks.
"Rachel, remember Cato? Remember what I taught you?"
"Yes."
"I need you to show me."
"He's too big."
The trench cocked his head. Did he even understand English?
"That's right, Rachel, that's right. You can't throw him. But you can throw yourself."
"Mo, what are you doing?"
"Shh, Goldie, just get ready."
The siren was growing louder. Kaufman heard a screech of tire and doors slam.
"You think you can do that, kiddo?"
"Yes,"
she sobbed. A voice called out below.
"Hey, get back here."
The trench glanced over the rail. Kaufman pulled his gun.
"Now, Rachel, now."
The girl reached out and grasped the spook's shoulder, tucked in her head, and flipped herself up. Kaufman jolted forward. She was still in the trench's claws, only upside down. He tried to right her as she squirmed, but a dimpled knee knocked him in the mouth, smushed the cigarette, and set embers in his eye. Kaufman grabbed his hand as it brushed away the sparks.
"Go on, Goldie,"
he shouted.
"Get the girl."
Goldstein scooped Rachel up and darted for the stairs. Kaufman twisted the trench's arm up behind him, shoved the gun barrel under his jaw. Another bellow from below. The same voice. Trask.
"Hey! Do you hear me? Put down that weapon!"
"Can't do that," Kaufman thought. The Luger was part of him now. Or he was part of the Luger. Blood become oil. Muscle. Steel. The trench struggled to get loose, but Kaufman had him in a lock.
"I said put it down, Kaufman! Drop it! Drop the goddamn dagger!"
Dagger? What dagger? He didn't have any dagger. Kaufman's finger tightened on the trigger. Gulls swooped in around them. Wind raged, and a violent gust swept in, snatched the hat from the trench's head, and sent it sailing into the void. The hat vanished. Their eyes met.
Minya.
What language was that? Kaufman's throat tied in a knot.
Minya Irma,
he whispered. The boy's face was dark, heart-shaped, except for the faint wisp of a mustache. He looked just like her. Her eyes, her nose, her lips.
I said drop the weapon!
The voice was a blend of fury and fear. Kaufman relaxed his hold, released the pistol, and the boy slowly stepped away. He blinked and slipped a trembling hand into the pocket of his coat.
Drop the dagger, damn it!
But the boy didn't have a dagger either. He didn't have much of anything. When he pulled out his hand, all there was a crucifix. He lifted it to his lips and leaned backwards over the railing. He fell much the way Patrick Walsh must have fallen, though from a considerably steeper height, and without assistance.
Kaufman, no!
The voice again, followed by the shrill scream of a child. Kaufman, no. What Kaufman was Trask shouting at? There was only one Kaufman. No, there wasn't. There were two. One who should have remained back at the beach. He turned and took to the stairs, bounded down the steps, four and five at a time, swinging himself from the iron rail, tunneling downward, bone mashed against bone with every leap, ribs about to burst. But he was beyond pain. All he could think about was the other Kaufman. He hit the landing and stumbled forward. The earth shifted under him. His feet wouldn't hold. He braced himself in the doorway. Hattery and Trask were there, looking stunned. Hattery, hat clenched to his chest. Trask, gun drawn, but aimed at nothing. The two officers looked over at the body of the Portuguese boy, twisted and torn to pieces. Then they looked at the man on the walkway, Goldstein. He was crumpled to his knees. The other Kaufman stood nearby, Rachel in one arm, the other arm dangling by his side. At the end of that arm was a dagger, an army-issue K-bar, dripping blood.
I think he got one of them vital organs, Mo. Ain't that the luck?
Quiet, Goldie.
Kaufman knelt beside him.
I'm sorry, Moses, Eli said softly. I'm sorry. How could I know? I thought. I mean, it was my daughter. My daughter.
I told you to stay at the beach, Eli.
I'd seen this man. I'd seen him before, spying. I didn't know. She's my little girl, Moses. My little girl.
Eli bowed his head, rocked back and forth.
God, forgive me.
Kaufman still wasn't sure about God, but this wasn't an issue of God's forgiveness anyway, just a brother's forgiveness.
I know, Eli, I know. Just take Rachel away, will you?
I'll radio for an ambulance.
The cop was holstering his pistol. Kaufman noticed his hand was shaking.
Always one step ahead, aren't you, Trask?
Don't push it, Kaufman. Hattery! Get the girl and her pop and bring him to the car.
Hattery wiped his face. He waddled over to Eli and Rachel, looped a meaty arm around them both, and ushered them away. Seemed Laurel and Hardy weren't so funny anymore.
I'm kind of scared, Mo.
Shh, Goldie. You're gonna be fine.
Goldstein coughed up a cup of blood.
You're gonna say Kaddish for me?
What?
I asked if you're gonna say Kaddish, schmuck.
Yeah, of course. Of course I will, Goldie. I'll light a yard site. I'll daven. But you're not dying. Not here.
Why not here? Better I bite it in the big one? Newport, Normandy. What's it matter?
He was right. It didn't matter. And with any luck, Kaufman would be joining him soon enough. But he couldn't tell Goldstein that. All he could say was,
I'm telling you, you're not gonna die.
Thank you, Florence Nightingale. Listen, Mo, can you do me a favor?
Name it.
Can you tell Charlene I saved the kid?
You did save her, Goldie. You're a fucking hero.
But don't go burying me in no Arlington Cemetery. Too many goys.
Listen to me. You're not dying.
Hey, it's not everybody gets to die a hero. And I served with one of the toughest sons of bitches around. Maybe you heard of him. Mo Kaufman?
Nope. Don't know him.
Well, you will someday, buddy boy. Someday you will.
A tear fell from Kaufman's eye, and Goldstein died in his arms.
Ambulance should be here any sec.
Trask twined his fingers and gave his knuckles a crack.
Doesn't matter now, does it?
Maybe not for him, but you.
Me?
Kaufman looked up at the cop. Trask pointed to the puddle at Kaufman's feet. It wasn't all Goldstein's.
It's fucked, Trask said. The whole thing's fucked. I couldn't shoot. I couldn't shoot the goddamn gun. Couldn't even fire a warning shot.
I killed him,
Kaufman said, smoothing Goldstein's hair.
What you talking about? Your brother did it.
Him, too.
Kaufman pointed to the broken boy on the boulders.
Him? Who cares? He's just a Portuguese. But we're gonna have to do something with Eli.
It was her brother.
What?
The Portuguese. It was Teresa's brother.
But Kaufman was already wandering off. He climbed out over the bluff, towards the sea. Gulls screamed in the darkening sky, and the salty spray swiped at his shoes. Chapter 81.
Need a lift?
It was Mara in the Delahaye. Bradley Glenn was behind the wheel.
Haven't quite charted my destination.
Kaufman eyed her coolly.
Been calling the hospital. They said you'd be discharged today.
She hopped out of the car, pulled a Lord and Taylor bag from the well.
had to guess the size,
she said, reached in and withdrew a fedora. He fiddled with the brim and fashioned it on his head. Not bad for guesswork.
This is also for you.
She held out an envelope, fat, with a rubber band around the middle. He tossed it hand to hand.
Seems a little on the heavy side.
So what?
So, if you think money's gonna make it any easier...
Please.
She raised a hand to hush him.
I'm really sorry, Mo, about everything.
Yeah. You got a world of worry, too, I suppose.
He slid the cash into his breast pocket.
By the way, thanks for posting bail on Eli.
It was the least I could do.
He'll get off. He's got every Levite lawyer within 100 miles working for him. Then he just has to live with himself.
We all do.
She'd aged, the girl. Weariness drew down her face, ringed her eyes. Kaufman slipped off the hat.
Yeah, he said softly. Yeah, we all do.
She looked up at him, then turned to Glenn. He drummed his fingers on the steering wheel, squinting into the sun. Everyone has to live with himself, or herself. Only the dead are exempt. Mara lifted up on her toes and gave him a quick peck on the cheek. Then she climbed back in the car and took Glenn by the arm. She gripped him too tight to mistake it for affection. Glenn gunned the engine, gave Kaufman a nod. Kaufman nodded back. He turned away before they did, placed the hat squarely on his head, and set off toward Water Street. He imagined the kid glancing over her shoulder at him one last time, but didn't look back. Sully's tavern was only a few blocks away, but at a further distance, over Point Street Bridge, was another sort of meeting place. Not the kind he wanted, but maybe what he needed. Kaufman patted his pants leg. It was still there. He reached into his pocket and pulled out Fry's folded piece of paper. Well, that's it. That's the end of Kaufman's Holiday. Episode 15, Chapters 80 and 81. We finished up with Part 3 here, A Beacon of Light. Part 2 was The Man in the Tunnel. And the first part was Pagan Rites. If you missed any of it, or want to listen again, all the episodes are archived. I hope you enjoyed yourselves. I certainly did, though parting's not always so sweet a sorrow. Once again, we're coming in under time. That's how it goes. But it'll give me a few minutes to talk about the story, if you don't mind indulging me. So let's put a fade on the music, shall we? There. That's better. So let me talk about Kaufman's Holiday. Why Kaufman? Why not? Might as well begin with, why a story? I've drawn, painted, sculpted, acted, directed, done stand-up and mime, but I've always written, and I've always felt that, whatever the medium, It's about telling a story. And one of the things for me is that I'm not even so much telling a story to you. Sorry, but that's the truth. It's more that I'm telling a story to myself. Because all of my stories come from a question, or a multitude of questions. Even if I know how they'll begin, and even if I know how they'll end, which I often don't, I still don't know what path they're going to take to get there. It's an improvisation, and I expect to be surprised as much as anyone with the twists and turns. And I expect to be challenged, to be thwarted, to be forced to dig deeper and deeper into my own nature, which is, in fact, the nature of whatever character I've created. Something will be revealed. Something will be discovered. I might not even get it until it's all over. You see, I don't create to offer up what I know already. I enter a question, and maybe I'll find something out. It's a little bit like detective work. And that brings us back to Kaufman. Truth be told, I was never a big fan of detective fiction. Sure, as a kid I liked the Hardy Boys, and as I approached Kaufman's Holiday, I immersed myself in the realm of the hard-boiled. But I did like imagining myself as a detective. I honestly can't say how Kaufman sprang up. I had some idea. Actually, it was, again, a question. What would it have been like for a Jewish detective to investigate the death of an anti-Semitic war hero? And to stack the deck against him, always more interesting, what if he was a conflicted Jew at best, self-loathing at worst, and an alcoholic? And what if he had to really confront the specter of the Holocaust? One of the things I saw in the classic detective novels was that the detective was the same from beginning to end. Maybe the story ended well for him, maybe it didn't. If he drank, most did, he was more or less drunk the whole time. Seems that was the case for many of the authors as well. But I'm interested in change, in personal evolution, or at least the effort of such. I don't separate my art from my life, and if my art doesn't aid my development, I have to make some adaptations. For me, there's a back and forth, the art informing the life, and the life informing the art. Now, I am a conflicted Jew, and I have avoided contemplating the incomprehensible Holocaust, and I knew Kaufman would force me into some kind of reconciliation. And that's why a story, and why this story. I have more in common with Kaufman. No one died, but I did get mashed up in an automobile accident, and I was in the passenger seat, and the driver was drunk. And Kaufman's scars pretty well mirror my own. Also, I grew up in Newport, and found it a strange and charming town. It seemed to me as a child to be pleasantly homogeneous. Kids of different colors, different religions, different incomes, all playing together. I'm sure there was racism, but I didn't encounter that until I moved to Virginia, and there I encountered it every day. That's where the self-loathing began for me. But I have to say that even in Newport, and I went to Turo Synagogue there regularly, I couldn't get into the whole religion thing. I guess that was something else I wanted to investigate. So I needed Kaufman to be a broken man. Protagonists are often given a fatal flaw. Kaufman had a file cabinet full of them. But I gave him other qualities, too. Some I might even have myself. I don't deny Kaufman as an alter ego. He's quick-witted, incisive. He stands up to authority. He can hold court as easily with millionaires as with the servants of millionaires. He doesn't judge by color, income, sexual preference. He sees people as people, and he respects them. He might be sardonic, ironic, skeptical, but he's loyal, and he's committed to helping the underdog. He's a keen reader of behavior, but he can still be duped, and he can be impulsive, impulsive to the point of making some pretty lethal mistakes. The point was to give Kaufman some semblance of a hero's journey, knowing he would be different by the end, but not knowing how that might look. Back to questions. Not knowing. I knew the case. Kaufman would investigate Patrick Walsh's death, but I didn't know, at first at least, whether or not Patrick had been murdered, because even if he hadn't, there could still be some heavy drama. And once I did decide on murder, I still didn't know by whom. Mara? Bradley? Clayton? One of the Patriots? I set up a bunch of suspects. The Patriots were all based on childhood friends, although none of my friends were rotten shtunks. They were all mensches. And then I worked my way through the suspects. I'd always planned on there being three mysteries, the soldier Walsh being preeminent, but also the arson that inflames Kaufman's parents, another fatal flaw. And then the cloaked figure. He came in later, I think, just to add a new level of difficulty for me. I did figure the Patriots would be responsible for the fire, and that fit into place quite nicely, though sooner than expected, which ended up being a fitting end for the first part of the story, Pagan Rites. But I never intended a three-part saga. I actually had no idea how long this book would be. I'd first imagined it as a TV series. But as the story developed, and as I became more and more enmeshed in research, oy, there was so much research, it became clear that this would be a pretty long journey. With the main mystery, Patrick's death was extra loaded with intrigue. Not only was I not sure he'd been murdered, I also didn't know what he'd done in the war that got him wounded and sent home. I knew it had to be despicable. And then I waded into the history of the Holocaust. First, just reading up about the Holocaust, forcing myself to see the pictures. I read Primo Levi, Viktor Frankl. This, of course, is the work on myself. Then I had to find a camp, but not a camp that was too well known, and it had to have been liberated by the U.S. And that led me to the horror that was Dora Mittelbau. The Rebbe I'd always planned for, but I didn't know if Kaufman would find him in New York or in Germany. But when I looked into overseas travel, I found out that flights weren't available at that time. I couldn't have Kaufman on a boat for a month. I remember asking my writing group if I should send Kaufman over, have a direct experience of the Holocaust, or not. Probably a question that had some personal resonance. They all said, send him. So then I had to figure out how the hell to get Kaufman over to Europe. I already had the colonel in play, so I let him figure that one out. The colonel was actually based on a Lieutenant Leon Suick, and yes, his nickname was Babe. He was the one who first told me about anti-Semitism among the armed forces. I followed that with the book G.I. Jew. It told me a lot more about it. But when I began this story, that was just my imagination working. And again, with the Rebbe, I didn't know in advance what he'd been through and how he'd end up, but I wanted my Krishna on the battlefield. I wanted a sage in this story. On my own journey of self-inquiry, I've studied with some truly remarkable men and women, and I wanted someone who could give voice to esoteric teachings, but put in a natural as opposed to metaphysical way. Took some experimentation, but settling on a botanist felt perfect. Once I had the Rebbe and Dora Mittelbau, the brutality of the moment in the tunnel became unavoidable, and it gave me every reason to have Patrick murdered. It also gave me some additional suspects, and an enjoyable exercise finding out who that might be, and who it couldn't be. This went somehow hand in hand with the cloak figure. Who would that be? I'd thought Mara would have her brother killed at first. I also thought Kaufman and Mara would have an affair, or that he would succumb to her advances. I was advised that would be too creepy. but it did open the doors for a love interest, and another world to explore. The black culture at this time. There's always seemed some sort of parallel between the oppression of Jews and blacks, at least from a Jewish perspective. Why so many Jews standing up, marching, fighting for civil rights? But it also plays into Kaufman's non-Jewishness. He was never going to date a Jewish gal. So I gave him Therese, which ended in tragedy, another flaw, and then Allegra, which didn't end quite so tragically, but it could have, and that was the point. Opening up Clayton Walsh's secret dealings was fascinating. I'd wanted the book to start right after Germany's defeat and end right before the atomic bomb. That gave me a time frame. It also gave me the 4th of July to use, and the phases of the moon, which led me to the actual solar eclipse. And that became a date with a particularly ominous purpose. I had always planned to have Kaufman fall off the wagon. So Hitler dies, Kaufman has his adventure, atom bomb gets built, we end there. And just as I had asked, what if there were anti-Semites in the U.S. forces, without knowing there actually had been, I asked, what if the private sector had invested in the atom bomb, without knowing anything at all? And it was hard to find any information on that count. But eventually I came across an unpublished pamphlet of the finances of the Manhattan Project. A big wow. And I thought I'd been writing fiction. So that all tied up nicely. And I loved letting Ben Horner swing the club. Which brings me to the issue of violence. Hey, there has to be violence. Otherwise, this wouldn't be noir. From Eli's wife with the dagger to Horner's smashing in Clayton's skull, I wanted violence to come out of the blue, out of left field. Not where we'd expect it from. Not where Kaufman would expect it from. That seems more natural for me. We're all capable of violence. I didn't want heroics in some obvious form. Not even the Rebbe is a hero in the end. And I didn't want to promote a sense of unabashed victory. Kaufman toasts flatly to victory early in the first scene. And if you look at World War II and the Jews and the atom bomb, well, how sweet do you really want that victory to taste? And it became inevitable that the cloak would be a victim himself. He would die much the way Patrick Walsh had died, but he would die sadly at his own hands. And the death of Goldie would also be inevitable. Goldie would have to die from a lousy misunderstanding and at the hands of someone who meant well, but was caught up in a reaction instead of actually taking action. Goldie had to die, and Kaufman had to be set onto a straighter path. So we leave Kaufman taking action. The address, the paper in his pocket. It's for one of the earliest AA meetings in Rhode Island. And for now, at least, the holiday has ended. And the story has ended. But maybe Kaufman has not ended. So what do you say we bring back in our music and close out this caper? Radio Free Brooklyn have been our noble hosts here on Sunday Night Noir, and I think they've done a bang-up job. If you think so, too, how about expressing yourselves? Candy would be nice, but cash would be a lot nicer. So do it. Go to RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/pledge. They even offer some nifty perks. And if you got a special yen for Kaufman's holiday, Why not consider sponsoring it? I'd also prefer that to candy. And if you want more details on the story, feel free to write me. Thanks to Chris Durian for our theme song. I hunted around a long time before finding it, on YouTube no less. It's called Case Closed, and it features Brian Schwartz on trumpet and Sang-hee Cho on piano. That's it right now, underscoring my wry delivery. And a very special thanks to my dear friend Arthur Rosen, who came up with all those mellifluous piano improvisations. You can hear more from him at the end. I guess that's it then. Better quit before I get all verklempt. All right, this is Matt Mittler signing off. And you never know, maybe I'll be back. If so, I'm sure you'll hear me coming. My floor shines, clacking on the cobblestones. Thank you.
Thank you.